Tonight, dear brothers and sisters, Brother James Wharton is to give the introductory address on a series we're having on the prophecy of Daniel, and tonight's subject is the history, setting and introduction to that prophecy, of course. And he's asked that we read by way of introduction from the first chapter of Daniel's prophecy. So it's my pleasure now to hand over to James, the prophecy of Daniel, history, setting, and introduction. James.
So, the book of Daniel. It's by far and away one of the strongest contenders for being the most well-known and the most famous book of the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament has many famous tales, but the setting in this one is dramatic by itself, and the words of prophecy in the stories can capture quite literally anyone's imagination. The book of Daniel has inspired metaphors, it's inspired children's tales, sayings, music, diverse commentaries, and a huge host of other materials. And that includes our own exhibitions, it includes our own lectures and our Sunday schools. And it's quite easy to lose sight of just how personal and real this book was to those who had to take part in the events that it records. And in some ways, because it's so famous and because it's so well known, it's very easy to lose sight of its actual meaning for ourselves and how we can't just get drawn away thinking that it's just a story. In this address, we'll look at where Daniel was, who he was, and how he set the scene for historical events in which God really did change the path for the Jewish people. So, Daniel is described as the last of the great or the major prophets, but of course the book that bears Daniel's name is much closer to the length of what we actually call the minor prophets, the Book of the Twelve. He was a contemporary and quite possibly a friend and encourager of Ezekiel, and little of his family background appears to be specifically known. It would seem to be the case that his upbringing was rudely and probably very traumatically interrupted by a forcible exile to Babylon. He was taken captive around 605 to 597 BC. And that was a time when Babylonians were gaining power rapidly, but they very much wanted to retain power amongst the other empires rising around them. They'd already made terrific advances at exactly the point when Daniel would have been travelling into Babylon, and that would have been on his mind. He wouldn't have known how many more people there would be following him, and who else would be arriving, how much more crowded and busy the cities of the area would become, and how he would cope with the immense import of exiles, because the Babylonians were so keen to show that they could draw people away from their home countries. Now, Judah was situated right in the middle of the conflicting empires of Egypt and Babylon, something echoed by Daniel's prophecies in chapter 11, where he talks about a king of the north and the king of the south, albeit different empires for one of them, Syria versus Babylon, but on the other hand, he was still talking about Egypt, which was a power throughout Daniel's life. At the time of Daniel, we can see what the history books would tell us are an immeasurable amount of historical events. The Medes, the Persians, and the establishment of the Greeks, as well as the continuing turmoil caused by the Babylonians. At this particular point in history, I think it's fair to say that the amount of literature that was produced explodes in volume by these countries. They created a huge amount of history and wrote it all down, and it's much clearer than a lot of other times. But that didn't help at the time of Daniel for him. With the trauma of the exile to a foreign land and situated the other side of a desert remote from anyone else, it would have brought back childhood stories of venturing into the unknown at the Exodus. And the empires of very much further away times. So those sorts of stories would have formed the basis of his spiritual career. It wouldn't have been easy for him to see the current plan of events except through exactly what God revealed to him and the examples from his childhood stories, which were clearly to be told amongst their families at events like the Passover. So, Daniel. The best way to introduce and summarise the character of Daniel is very neatly and deliberately shown in his name. The name of Daniel is very much actually like the name of Malachi, whose name meant my messenger. Daniel's name also shows his purpose very well, very clearly, and it shows the wisdom that controlled his life. Daniel means, as you can see, God is my judge. There isn't any more fitting way to start this address. As an aside, this is remarkably different to the names of his contemporaries in Gentile civilizations. The name Nebuchadnezzar, for example, is a morphed version of a Babylonian name which has approximately three separate meanings, none of which are particularly easy to translate, but they vary from a dedication of worship to a declaration of a firstborn son. So you can see that there's quite a variation there, whereas Daniel is completely unambiguous. So beyond any human control, Daniel was put in place with a singularity of purpose to reveal God's plan and supreme efforts to form the course of history and lead to the work of his son. The names given by the Babylonians to Daniel and his friends were almost entirely the polar opposites of God's purpose. And there's very little relevance to their lives other than the opportunity for us to show the spectacularly failed brainwashing of Babylon's court. They turned Daniel's name round to Belteshazzar, meaning Bel, protect his life, which is completely irrelevant against the power of God. We have to wonder what exactly Daniel thought when he was given that name. He would have known the ancient tales of Israel where they looked at the change of Abraham's name, for example. And they would have looked at, he would have looked at that and thought, well, why is God allowing this to happen to me? Why is this useless name being given to me? So I think really he would have stuck with the name of Daniel between probably his Jewish friends and those who knew him most. Now, there's much that's been written about the history at the times portrayed by the book of Daniel, as I've said. The histories of the writings themselves have to be the first thing we consider and summarise. Like any other book of the Bible, there's been a fair amount of very controversial discussion about the veracity of its origins and the time when Daniel was written. Various critical writers have claimed it was written a significant time after the year 600 BC. And it has to be pointed out that the origin of most of the criticism is a general disbelief in the power of prophecy and not a critical study leading to a disbelief in the power of prophecy. The upsurge in this came about only about 150 years ago amongst so-called Christian writers, mainly around 1870. There are writers that believe certain parts of the history are inconsistent with what actually happened, but in fact it appears that Daniel's record is simply heavily abridged. That's perfectly acceptable because we consider that there are vast tracts of global history which the Bible has to omit completely because they're not necessary for our core knowledge of God's purpose. Others say that the particular chapters, including prophecies of the kings of the north and south, were probably written at the times of the wars that they portray between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, the Egyptians and the Syrians, in order to bring encouragement to the Maccabean era Jews of the firmness of God's purpose. Really, that theory is not only 500 years out of date, as timings of Daniel's life go, but it's also derived as a theory from the works of the very deeply disbelieving writer Porphyry, who actually, apparently, can only be found due to a complete accident of history by being quoted by others. Apparently, all his original works have been completely destroyed. And if it wasn't for the accidents of history being recorded by others, Porphyry would probably be completely unknown to those in the 1870s who started to doubt Daniel. And it's highly illogical to suggest that the first fulfilment of these prophecies found in Daniel 11 happened at the same time or after they were written. There would be absolutely no benefit whatsoever for those writing in such detail to then fail to explicitly name who they would then have known to be the ruling powers and they would have known to be the other characters involved, rather than naming them in code. And there would be little benefit for a human writer providing short-term encouragement like this, because it would have been seen to be too vague. It wouldn't have boosted morale at all to know slightly what people were doing, but not entirely, because they weren't named. In addition to this, there are various works from the time of the Maccabeans which suggest that the writings of Daniel were already held in very high regard by this point, and therefore were part of a very established religious tradition. Now, you can see there the picture there of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that's actually a copy of Daniel, and I believe that's part of the Aramaic text. And that was part of a collection which was gathered up in a great hurry of the most respected works, which wouldn't have just been done if it was a piece of morale-boosting propaganda from the time. The Septuagint version of Daniel was written in a very heavily modified format, and at a date no later than approximately 280 BC. And the modifications there were because, by that point, the language was already obsolete in the text, and the words they were using had absolutely no bearing on particularly the marriage cultures that existed at the time, meaning that it was actually unintelligible already by 280 BC. Now, the language of the Book of Daniel is also interesting, and if you read it in English, there's no clear change in style or purpose in the book. But as many of you will know, it's written in two separate languages. Now, the author in the second part of the book often begins with the phrase, "I, Daniel," seven times in the King James Version as it's translated, but doesn't do that at all in the first part of the book. But you might think that's because of the divide in language, but actually it isn't. It simply appears to be a divine purpose because God wanted to show that he was judging the world to come. It can really be read apparently in the Aramaic as God has judged as follows, rather than "I, Daniel." So it's effectively saying God has judged the path of history as will come. And it's effectively showing a divine phrase, meaning that God is predicting what is to happen. But instead, the division in the languages is significant in the following way. From the beginning of Daniel through to chapter 2, verse 4, the start of the conversation about the first interpretation of prophecy, and then from chapter 8, verse 1 to the end, that's all written in Hebrew. So the first and the last parts are written in Hebrew, and this provides the setting of the book which we're looking at this evening. And it also contains the final purpose of God. Now, in between this, Daniel was written in Aramaic. Now, Aramaic is a long-standing language, and it would have been well understood both by the Jews at the time and in the region. But it would have been entirely suitable for prophecies and interpretations largely based on the works of Gentile powers. The Aramaic of Daniel is part of an early tradition, and hopefully, understandably, I'm not an Aramaic scholar. I've got no particularly good abilities in interpreting Aramaic, but it's supposed that the Aramaic used in Daniel was imperial Aramaic from as early as the 7th century BC. Now, this ties in perfectly with the time it was meant to have been written, and that means that we can date the book almost exactly to the time that Daniel was meant to have lived, rather than the time that scholars approximately 120 years ago said that Daniel lived. The history of Israel and Judah around this time was so dramatic that it seems highly unlikely, apparently, that any knowledge of imperial Aramaic would have been exported from Babylon to the Maccabeans. Daniel's contemporaries and the empires around Daniel. What was happening with the world's history and God's purpose in Israel and Judah in Daniel's days? Now, as I've said earlier, the answer is unsurprisingly quite a lot. Now, we're going to look at a broad overview of who was living around Daniel's life. And this is a timeline I've collated from a number of different sort of reference works, including several study Bibles. And this is the basic overview before we look at a sort of a more detailed timeline. So we're looking at here a period of, as you can see, a couple of hundred years, and we can see the path where Isaiah was prophesying, and then we've got a space of approximately 100 years with Hezekiah, Sennacherib, and moving on to Jeremiah. And this is where it becomes obviously much more interesting to us for tonight, because we're then looking at Josiah, who was involved in the early battles of the Egyptians and the Babylonians, as we'll see in a minute. And then we can see down Jehoiakim, Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar II, as he actually was, and Daniel, Ezekiel being contemporaries, and moving on to Darius and Cyrus. Now, if we look at that, it appears to be a completely clear-cut picture, just a flow of history. But if you look at it in a bit more detail, the volume of prophecy around this time was incredible, and for those who were faithful, very encouraging. And Daniel and Ezekiel at the same time prophesying very largely different things and in completely different ways, and yet contemporaries around the times of these empires. So Daniel was a contemporary of Ezekiel and slightly less so a contemporary of Jeremiah. Jeremiah wrote about the exile to Babylon. Some of the kings he mentions in Jeremiah 52 would almost certainly have appeared in the court before Daniel, although Daniel's mostly silent about these sorts of things. He was instead concerned with the wider picture of empires. He was concerned with demonstrating the fearsome power of God over the whole lot. The writer of the second book of Kings was also present around these times, and that writer provides a completely separate picture as well of a more day-to-day narrative of the Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem. Now, it's not explicitly clear who wrote Jeremiah, whether it was Jeremiah who wrote the second book of Kings, but whoever wrote the second book of Kings was extremely familiar with prophecy, but wasn't identified for some reason, which I find quite interesting. So the day-to-day narrative, the person isn't even mentioned who wrote it. So these are the chapters where we can find the contemporaries of Daniel. And as you can see, we've got only a handful of really significant sections, but it's enough to see that there was an immense volume of spiritual activity to drive that period through. And Ezekiel mentions Daniel twice in chapter 14. Ezekiel mentions Daniel twice in chapter 14 alone, and then in a sort of scathing and very mocking way of the local civilizations in chapter 28. So here's a more detailed timeline of the times around Daniel. So we can see here that this is a time of immense warfare. The population of Israel and Judah didn't know what was coming, really. It was fair to say that they hadn't listened to what was being told to them, and they were right in the middle, caught up in a sandwich between the ruling powers of the time. Most of the sources that I found appear to broadly agree on these dates, so we can be fairly confident, and we can also tie them in with what's written in terms of the years listed for when the kings in the second book of Kings were mentioned. Daniel, it seems, may have been amongst a number of exiles who were taken captive in 605 BC as possibly almost like a deposit scheme to see if the people of Judah would behave themselves, to see if the kings would do what was acceptable in the eyes of the Babylonians, who are now, as you can see, conquering the areas previously held by Pharaoh Necho, and to see if really the people of Judah wanted their captives back enough to behave themselves. 605 is the earliest possible time of Daniel's captivity, apparently. Only a year after Nebuchadnezzar took the throne. Nebuchadnezzar took the throne at a time when he wasn't expected. It took him just 21 days after inflicting losses in Egypt to rush back across the desert and steal the throne. And thereafter, he was very much firmly in control. He already had a significant battle barely before he even came to power. It was a sudden and decisive victory. And then he appeared before anyone expected him on the throne of Babylon. Then just a couple of years later, Jehoiakim dies. He was buried humiliatingly, and it says in the scriptures, like an ass. He was buried as a donkey with completely no ceremony whatsoever. And then Jehoiachin began his reign. That was only 3 months long. Then Zedekiah was on the throne. Ezekiel was exiled. And just a few years after that, the siege against Zedekiah began. Now, when we look at the first chapter of the book of Daniel, the word bring that's mentioned when he was brought to the royal court apparently does not necessarily refer to the travel all the way from Judah. It could in fact mean that Daniel had already been there for a few years, settling in or being selected. But it doesn't mean that Daniel would go back there anytime soon. Because of the fact that the kings of Judah failed to do what they were told, Daniel would never leave. So Daniel was there for the full 70 years that Jerusalem was effectively abandoned. He was inducted into the well-known court or palace school, which was an established function of the Babylonian Empire. It's suggested even that the word Babylon is too broad here. When the King James Version especially translates it as Chaldean or Chaldees, that's a much more accurate version. A lot of these kings mentioned here were Chaldean and not Babylonian. Chaldean refers to a very specific tribe, a very select tribe, who first emerged about 100 years before these times. The Chaldeans were a people who thought themselves to be elite, and the assassinations that occasionally occurred, as you can see, two of them alone are listed on the screen there, those assassinations were often the result of the rivalry and the things that they thought that they were elite and above each other. Now, despite Nebuchadnezzar being the commander of a successful army, king of a large empire and ruler of a fortified and majestic city, he would also have been expected to attend this school in his youth. And pushing the captives through the education that he went through as well would have meant that they could converse with the king and would be not mere soothsayers, but they would be members of the nobility. They would have effectively become elite Chaldeans. Now, what possible reason could there be for foreigners to have to do this? Well, evidently the king was aware by now that the Jewish nobility could very easily try to be stubborn and rebel against him. So they needed to have it ingrained in them that this was the way, in his eyes, to behave. This was effectively indoctrination at the highest possible level. They changed their names, they changed their culture. We don't know how many of Judah's nobility succumbed to this. What we do know is that from the start, most other young men of his age consumed the royal food and drink, quite possibly sacrificed to idols or containing blood. And they were probably no doubt an error in other ways. So the brainwashing evidently worked. It was only Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah that remained. Now the following example comes to mind in the first book of Kings, chapter 19. 1 Kings 19, verses 13 to 18. And I think this is, in a strange sort of way, very similar. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, "What dost thou hear, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And then a little later, God said, Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed down unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. A very similar picture, but on a smaller scale, emerges with Daniel and his three friends, the only ones left. And Daniel probably would have prayed to God, thinking, is there anyone left? And maybe these three friends came and emerged and showed themselves as faithful. So Daniel set a great example with his faith, and one which goes right through the book. Daniel and his friends evidently shared this completely equally. I think it's entirely possible that the words of Corinthians are designed to echo this, where it says, and I'll read this to you, "Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one loaf, we who are many are one body, for we all share the one loaf. Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in the altar? Do I mean then that food sacrificed to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God, and I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he? I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but not everything is constructive. Likewise, Paul shared the faith of Daniel, and in the end of his life, various deliverances were very much reflective of the book of Daniel. Whilst it may seem a lightweight matter to resist food and drink and other customs of those around us in order to seek the ways of God, we should consider the second book of Timothy, chapter 4. 2 Timothy, chapter 4, verses 16 to 18. At my first defence, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them. But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be glory for ever and ever. Amen." So aside from these references in the New Testament that we've just looked at, the whole life of Daniel was full of signs, it was full of symbols, it was full of types. And the prophecies will be looked at, God willing, in future instalments in this series. But what symbology is there to keep ourselves aware of about Daniel himself, by means of introduction? Well, in a way, Daniel can be seen as a later rendition of the example shown in the life of Moses and the Exodus. We know that Moses was educated in Pharaoh's court, but he did not believe the message of Egypt. God showed him that he was to deliver Israel, but not immediately. He couldn't just kill the one Egyptian and then carry on. So Daniel prophesied centuries of conquests, battles, and empires which would eventually control the promised land, and Moses had to go into the desert and find out the message of God. And both had to wait a long time for God to bring his people back to the land. Only when they understood the full process of saving the people would they be allowed to see that happen. Now, Moses wandered in the wilderness and then never made it to the promised land, but he was given rest by God. And we don't read that Daniel ever actually got back to the land of Israel and Judah. Now let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 34, verses 4 to 6. Deuteronomy 34. "And the Lord said unto him, This is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor, but no man knoweth of his sepulchre unto this day. Before Daniel found the rest that God promised him, he had much work to do. No doubt he would have seen the fulfilling of the prophecy in the bringing of the exiled kings of Judah to the high courts of Babylon. He may have seen Zedekiah tortured. He may have seen Jehoiachin at his own meal table after being given a respite. We can see there that evil Merodach did that. He was assassinated after 2 years, but in that time, Daniel may have seen the kings of Judah come to his very own house. I'm sure that Daniel would have been as active as possible in teaching God's word. It appears that most of the heads of the Magi, the Rabmags, scorned the Israelite people, but Daniel may have been elevated sufficiently to control them, and maybe he was a Rabmag himself, chief over the wise people. Like Joseph, he may have risen to sufficient power to at least provide for his own family of believers within a foreign land. And I think it's still just about slightly tentatively possible to say that those of the Magi, the wise men that we hear about in every nativity play, who looked out for the birth of Christ, may have known the words of Daniel and may have known of the coming of the hope of Israel. Throughout Daniel's life, he was subject to the threats of death and destruction. Like Jeremiah, he was subject to being holed up in a cave or a cistern, not with Jeremiah's cold mud and water, but with the heat of attack from lions. And as he was sealed up, it was like the reluctance of Pilate to let Jesus die, but there was certainty as he was sealed in the lion's den that he would be released, just as Christ was released from the tomb. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 34. Hebrews 11. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Now, if we look back to the words of Ezekiel, when Ezekiel referred to Daniel, this must have been after some of these trials that he experienced. In Ezekiel 14, verses 12 to 14, we read, "The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when the land sinneth against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out mine hand upon it, and will break the staff of the bread thereof, and will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God." And by that time, Noah and Job would have been well known, and therefore we can also conclude that Daniel was well known for his acts of faith and standing out in days of trouble. But despite this, we can also see lessons in the way that Daniel behaved. He didn't completely forsake the king's court. He still stood there, and he still served. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 to 17. "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God, honour all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honour the king." So in this address, we've dealt with, not in any great way, the prophecies or their fulfilments. And this may seem to be an oversight, but I've tried to introduce the setting of Daniel and his work in the court of Babylon without overlapping the subject matter of the other addresses in the series. Hopefully this has been useful as a summary of Daniel's times and his character. At the end of his life, as we've touched on, Daniel was given words of great encouragement that he would close up the book, go on his way, and rest until his inheritance was made ready. Jesus confirmed these words, in Matthew chapter 24. These are selected verses from verses 15 to 31. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other.